Potrepreneurs in Humboldt County, California.
The descendants of ranchers and farmers and loggers, and then you've got the descendants of hippies, and they're all kind of farming weed side by side. They may have different politics, but they both believe what you do on your own land is your own business. And most of the problems associated with marijuana don't have to do with marijuana itself. They have to do with it being illegal. I think that I try and show that in the book.
That's Emily Brady. We talk with her about her book, Humboldt, Life on America's Marijuana Frontier. And Jonathan Edwards and Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God.
And he has an image in there of God dangling sinners over the fires of hell like a person might dangle a spider over the hearth fires. That's where the title of the book comes from.
That's Susan Stinson talking about her just-published novel, Spider in a Tree, in a new interview with Drew Adamack. It's about the brilliant 18th-century preacher Jonathan Edwards. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Humboldt County, California is famed for one thing, and it isn't the towering redwood forests that were once the bread and butter of its lumberjacks. The far more lucrative business of growing marijuana has long supplanted lumber as the economic engine of the region. From the hippies who started settling there in the 1960s to dyed-in-the-wool conservative locals, the money has been good for a long time. Journalist Emily Brady's book Humboldt explores that county's insular community. It's a place where business is done with thick wads of cash and savings are buried in the backyard. The weed economy supports everything from fire departments to schools, but it comes with a heavy price. As legalization looms, and medical marijuana is already legal, the community stands at a crossroads. Its residents are deeply divided on legalization. Some want to claim their rightful heritage as master growers, and they want their livelihood legitimized and regulated. Others want to continue reaping the inflated profits of the black market. Brady spent a year living with the highly secretive residents of Humboldt County. Her cast of intimately drawn characters takes the reader into a fascinating alternate universe. It's a story of a small town that became dependent on a forbidden plant, and how everything is changing as marijuana goes mainstream. Emily Brady's writing has appeared in the New York Times, Time Magazine, and The Village Voice, among other publications. Emily Brady, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you were born and raised in Northern California, just south of the Emerald Triangle. Tell us, what is the Emerald Triangle and what's it like?
Well, the Emerald Triangle is three counties, Humboldt, Mendocino, and Trinity, and they are considered the heartland of America's marijuana industry. And what it's like, my book is based in Humboldt, and just physically, it is a stunning, beautiful, wild place with more than half of the planet's remaining old-growth redwood forests. It's there's lots of hills and valleys. It's carpeted with trees. There's rivers that run through it. It's on the coast. There's a beautiful, rugged coastline. And it's a stunningly beautiful place. And it seems very far from civilization and from the law.
And from the law.
Mm-hmm.
And why did you add that?
Well, because marijuana has been grown there for decades, and for decades it was a place where the government tried to rein that in. Of course, everything is changing now with medical marijuana, but it's the community where I reported, Garberville, there was no Southern Humboldt. There was no mayor. There was no city council. There was one of the characters in my book is a frustrated sheriff deputy because he just feels that it's very liberal. It's sort of where the left and right meet. It's subtitle of the book is America's Marijuana Frontier, or Life on America's Marijuana Frontier, and it really felt that way. It's a frontier of sorts.
When you say left and right, do you mean it's kind of the place where, people have this rugged individualism that is connected with the counterculture?
Definitely. Well, not just the counterculture. So the counterculture would be the left, and then they meet with the right, which would be the people who traditionally come from families who logged or fished or ranched, and many of them grow marijuana now, too. as a way of preserving their livelihood and supporting, you know, living in a rural place, because it's very difficult to do in America these days and earn a living. So you've got the descendants of ranchers and farmers and loggers, and then you've got the descendants of hippies, and they're all kind of farming weed side by side. They may have different politics, but they both believe what you do on your own land is your own business.
And as you pointed out, that this is an area where it's very hard to make a living. A lot of folks moved there back in the 1960s and the early 70s to participate in the counterculture. Marijuana is something they smoked. Then they got into cultivating it. What happened when this became their business as opposed to just their culture?
So that's a great question. And what happened is it became marijuana in about 1973 or 1974. People discovered a growing technique called sensimilla, and it's how you can grow really potent marijuana. You remove the male flowers, so it's unpollinated, and there's a lot more THC, and that's why marijuana is much stronger now than it was in the early 60s or even in early 70s. So they discovered this way of growing marijuana that was much stronger, and it became worth a lot more in the cities, and people started to make a lot of money. And then it became a story of temptation. How much do you grow? How much do you risk? There were a few years where it was not as people weren't cracking down as hard. The government really started cracking down in the early 80s. But there were a few years in the late 70s that I think were golden years where people could, you know, were flush with cash. But one of the characters in my book, for instance, Mare, grows, I think, only six plants. And she always kept it very small. It was something she did to supplement her income. And I think a lot of the people who, the backs of the landers who sort of started growing, started the industry, many of them kept it small and grew a small crop and never got too big. Because if you get too big, you risk getting busted. You draw more attention. But some people realized you could make a lot of money on this and did make a lot of money on it and grew a lot of marijuana on their land and others' land and were very successful at it. And how much you grow, it's interesting in the culture. And with the people with counterculture roots always, like, they look down on big growers. Like, he's a big grower. That's a bad thing. And an old gentleman who sold a lot of land to the counterculture, his name is Bob McKee, and I mentioned him in the book, and he's quite famous in the area for having subdivided ranches and sold the parcels to people moving up from the city. And he said, I don't see anything wrong with growing a lot of pot. He's like, we admire Bill Gates for making a lot of money. I think he thinks it's the American way. So, it just becomes a story of temptation and how much you want to grow and risk. And also what happened, I should add, is that with the money came crime and violence, because it's a black market industry and there's nobody to regulate it, and you can't sue your business partner if they run off with your money or they don't come through on something. Unfortunately, there was a crime element that came in, and we saw that with alcohol prohibition as well. People don't kill each other over alcohol business anymore like they did in the 20s, but people sometimes do get killed over marijuana, and it's about business.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about your book, Humboldt, Life on America's Marijuana Frontier, is that you don't seem to have an attitude like pot is wrong. It's more that you're looking at the implications of this illegal industry and how its illegality, you know, has created some pretty intense problems in the area. Am I right in that? I mean, you don't really have problems with marijuana per se, but it's how it's grown.
Yeah, how it's grown and not regulated, I think would be, I don't have problems with marijuana. I think it should be, but I say at the end in my author's notes, I mean, the book isn't about me, but I'm sure my opinion leads in a little bit to how I write about it. But most of the problems associated with marijuana don't have to do with marijuana itself. They have to do with it being illegal. I think that I try and show that in the book. And, you know, people don't die from using marijuana. You can't. It's non-toxic. But people get killed over business deals because it's illegal. That doesn't mean everybody should be smoking it all the time. And you know, I think there should be moderated use. But we can't even have a conversation about that with it being illegal and not regulated.
And yet many of the very people that you write about in the book are adamantly against the legalization of marijuana. This really surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't they want it to be legalized?
Yeah, that was really surprised me too. I was really surprised about that. It was very counterintuitive. I thought these people would have been like the character mayor who'd been waiting decades to have her livelihood legitimized and to be able to say proudly, I'm a marijuana farmer and I grow amazing marijuana. And so there are people like that, but the majority are against legalization up there. And it's for the plain and simple economics, mainly, is that this is how they earn their living, and that because it's illegal, you know, some people refer to it as like the best government price support program in U.S. history. It makes this plant worth thousands of dollars a pound, or right now it's a little over 1,000. But before medical marijuana, which has changed the market, I know some people who got at least they got up to $6,000 a pound in the early 90s for their marijuana. It's more than gold. Right. Wow. Now that same marijuana is about $1,200 a pound. So there's been a huge price drop so far.
How has that happened? How has medical marijuana made that happen?
Well, it used to be that just outlaws and people risked a lot of jail time. There wasn't this shield of medical marijuana. And I guess it's important for people to know that, yes, I do believe in medical marijuana and that it's helpful to people. And there's studies that have proven, you know, and just anecdotally, you know, can help people who got cancer, you know, get their appetite and other things. And there's a lot more research that can be done. But I think that there's a lot of proof and more and more states adopting medical marijuana laws. It's on the rise, but there's also people who just use it recreationally. And what's happened is with medical marijuana is that many people who grow, they're not just growing medical marijuana. There's a lot there's a surplus and that's being sort of flooding the black market and it's going east and it's going to states that don't have medical marijuana laws. But because more and more people are able to grow and they have this medical card, so if the cops come to their house and they're like, well, it's my medicine, man, they have a protection. And so anybody can kind of do it now. You can get a medical marijuana card in California for anxiety or an insomnia. The law is quite loose. We have the loosest law. So there's a lot more marijuana on the market, and the prices have come down.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Emily Brady about her new book called Humboldt, Life on America's Marijuana Frontier. Now, you have a marvelous cast of characters in this book who represent different facets of the marijuana puzzle in Humboldt County. We've already talked about one of them, that's Mayor. How about some of the others on the other end of it, those who are part of the, you know, the big grower economy there? Crockett is one of those. Tell us about him.
Basically, and I'll just really quickly describe, I chose four different characters because I realized it's such a diverse culture and there was no one character who represented the whole place. There were these amazing back-to-the-landers who started the industry, and then there was this younger generation, and I would say it's a generational divide. And most of the younger growers grow a lot more marijuana than their elders, and are a lot more capitalist and treat it more like agriculture. And Crockett, the character Crockett, is one of them, and he works for somebody like a much bigger grower. These were definitely people that were hard to approach and to be involved in my book. So I was always very open that I was a journalist and I was writing this book, and I changed names, but that people would know who they were, basically. And Crockett he works in a garden where they're growing about 700 plants. He's working for a man, and it's called partnering, so he grows the crop and does all the manual labor associated with it, and then he's given a percent of the harvest. And if those plants had produced healthy buds and didn't get mold and didn't, whatever, there's a variety of things that can happen when you're farming, the garden would have been worth like over $1 million or around $1 million. So it was definitely a commercial endeavor. And Crockett also moves the marijuana out of Humboldt County. Most of marijuana, almost all of it, leaves. It's their crop, and he moves it to the city where brokers send it to other states. So he really shows how the black market works and how the bigger growers operate. And the gentleman he worked for instance, was against legalization, and he said, "I'm not in this for the money. I'm in this for a lot of money, and I don't want it to be legal."
So Crockett, in some ways, he's like a sharecropper, and he's taking all the risk, or almost all the risk.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. If he'd been busted, they've traced the land was in the man he works for, his name, but he definitely took the risk moving it in his car. And he had a coworker, so who shared in the risk with him. But I think they didn't think it was that risky because everybody is doing it. I mean, the thing is obviously not getting caught. And most of that happens when you're driving around in your car. You have it on you.
And yet some people do get caught. You talk mm-hmm. about Emma, who is mm-hmm. the child of growers, and she actually studied the phenomenon of what happens to the kids. I want to get back to that in a minute. But her brother, Mike, gets mm-hmm. into trouble. Talk about what happened to him.
Mike, yeah. Mike is actually sitting in prison right now, waiting to go to trial. He's accused of murdering a worker, a Guatemalan man who was working for him, and of shooting another one in the face. And this supposedly happened in a very large marijuana garden, so it would be double the size of Crockett and his boss's garden, Frankie. This marijuana garden was 1,500 plants, and it was in the northern part of Humboldt County. And there was an altercation, and somebody was left dead, and another person was injured, and Mike is in jail and is accused of murder and attempted murder and was involved in this marijuana grow.
And how did he get from kid to accused murderer?
I don't know a lot of his story because I wasn't able to interview him. His lawyers wouldn't let me talk to him. But from what I do know from Emma and talking to other siblings, this is her stepbrother. And he's actually written me a letter from prison. He read the book and apparently really liked it. And I'm looking forward to reading this letter that's coming. But he, like many young men in the community, did not go away to college. He dropped out of high school and started working in the industry, from what I understand. And he started out working as a little helper to a larger grower, which is kind of how you do it. You apprentice, and then you work your way up. You do manual labor, and then you work up to partnering, like what Crockett did, and then you're the actual sharecropper, and then you get enough money, and you buy your own land, and then you start having people work for you. And he had basically done that. So this land where this murder took place, the shooting took place, and where the 1,500 plants were growing was land that was bought in his name, or in a corporation that he registered, and he'd worked in the industry. He never went on to school. He never really left Humboldt, it seemed, and he apparently was a grower. And a lot of young men in the community who don't leave stay, and that is the industry, and some of them are like, I live in this beautiful place. Why would I want to leave? Here's this way I can make $100,000 a year cash and not go to college and be physical and live in a beautiful place.
So that's really one of the negative fallouts of the book, just the lure, the seduction of mm-hmm. all that money. And so that in some ways, makes these kids lack ambition to do anything else.
Yeah, and it's definitely, Emma's the third one of the four characters, and she tells the story, I think, very eloquently of her own story, which is quite compelling, and her mother growing up with a mother who grows and getting busted and what that experience is like. But she tells the story of the youth in the community, and many do leave, and there's some amazing, smart, brilliant people from that generation who've gotten out, but it seems in large the people who don't leave, Emma calls it kind of a lost generation, who don't develop other parts of themselves because there's just this easy way to make money. And it's not harmless because there is risk that comes with it.
Right. In fact, you say that a lot of the kids are dying young. Why is that?
Well, Emma did her research. So she's an example of a smart woman who left, and she did her research for her undergrad thesis. And on that very subject, she realized that she had more friends, like growing up in a rural community, she realized one day that more of her friends had died than the friend who grew up in a rough part of the inner city. And so she started looking into that and why there was such a high rate of youth death in the community. And she found there were a few reasons. One, she found that there was just a lot more risky behavior than in other parts of rural America. There's a lot of unpaved dirt roads up in Humboldt and a lot of reckless driving on them. And so some people died in accidents on these roads. She found that there was a higher rate of drug and alcohol use than in other parts of the state and in her county. The alternative schools have a much higher rate of drug and alcohol use. She also found that the secrecy associated with marijuana and with having your parents grow it and not being able to talk about it, and it was really detrimental, and that the secrecy, she called it the secrecy oxymoron. But basically, when your parents grow marijuana, you're taught not to talk about it because they risked jail time, especially in the 80s and 90s. So it was something you had to be really hush-hush about, and just growing up with that pressure and carrying that secret and not being able to be fully honest about who you are, even in a community where it's really common, turned out was very detrimental and had a lot of negative aspects. And then Emma had a friend who was murdered in a deal, and I tell that story in the book. That he was murdered just dealing with people he didn't know, and he was killed over 1 pound of marijuana, which is, it's a very small amount up there. It's like being murdered over a bottle of wine almost.
So are you saying that in some ways a culture of illegality leads to flouting of the rules or risky behavior in itself?
Yeah, I do. I think it's hard. How can you teach your children to follow the laws of society if you don't teach them? A young man I met there once told me he was born criminal because he was born into a family that was working outside the law. You view laws and the laws of society differently. And so there was a lot of pushing, just sort of falling over the edge because of not knowing where the edge was.
We're talking with Emily Brady. Her book is Humboldt, Life on America's Marijuana Frontier. There's also been a kind of international criminal involvement here, the Mexican drug gangs. What has been the impact of that on the growing, on what's going on there contemporaneously? I mean, this is a more recent phenomenon than the folks such as Mayer and other mm-hmm. other people in the book. What's happening with that?
Well, what's happening is that there are people growing vast amounts of marijuana on public land throughout California, and I believe in other parts of the country as well, but I'm obviously much more familiar with California. Authorities will find grows of thousands and thousands of plants, 15,000 plants, just monster grows, like in the middle of nowhere, nature, hours and hours from civilization. And often they'll find undocumented, poor Mexican workers manning them and living. I went to a few closer to where I grew up with authorities, and there was a tent set up. They were living in tents and had a little makeshift kitchen area, and there were tortillas and hot sauce on the ground, and it was obviously people of Mexican descent. What we don't know is who's behind this. There's a lot of talk of Mexican cartels, and it's obviously very scary because we hear reports and horrible, violent things happening south of the border. But so far, there's been no links, and there's actually been authorities have come out and said this, that like these aren't, like our informants have told us these aren't the Zetas or the Sinaloa cartel. And so I think that there's a lot of misinformation about it. I've interviewed a source from the DEA in the Central Valley, which is the closest I got to sort of finding out who these people are, because there's not a lot of adjudicated cases. And this gentleman said he worked for like a local Mexican family, and he delivered lunches to the workers. So as far as I can tell, it is small, sort of unorganized California-based Mexican crime, but it's not the cartels south of the border, and it's not at all as organized or as violent. But there's definitely, it's happening, and there might be some gringos doing it too. We don't know. But there's a lot of marijuana being grown, but it doesn't. My story focuses on people who are growing it on their land and in a community that's been doing it for decades. Yeah. I think basically it's a boogeyman that law enforcement holds up and the media just sort of repeats it. But it's been really, yeah.
So you think that actually there's kind of a boogeyman. So legalization might not have any impact in terms of, say, bringing Mexican drug gangs more into the growing of marijuana. I mean, what do you think would happen to the growing of marijuana? Would it explode if it became legalized? What's your sense of that? I mean, I also understand that, you know, companies like R.J. Reynolds have, mm-hmm. Patents on brand names for marijuana just waiting for it to be legalized. I mean, do you think that legalization would drive out you know, smaller growers and lead to concentration, even globalization, you know, Chinese marijuana.
Oh, yeah. I think definitely it will change when it becomes legal. And I think we're slowly moving towards legalization. And I think that prices will drop. Studies have shown that. I don't know to what extent. I don't think people will grow marijuana on public land anymore because it won't be worth as much money. And people aren't growing grapes there. You know, they're growing them in the Napa Valley and in the Central Valley. It won't be as profitable. So yes, unfortunately, I think it will be harder for the mom and pops to make a living at it. And I do believe big business will get involved. This is America. I think some of the big growers might be the first to convert themselves into the... But there's people in the cities who, they call them the potrepreneurs. And there was a lot of resentment in Humboldt towards the gentleman who put the legalization measure on the ballot in 2010. His name is Richard Lee, and he had a marijuana trade school where you could learn how to grow marijuana in your garage. He called it Oaksterdam University here in Oakland where I live. And so there's definitely big players involved, and even the family that Miracle-Gro. I remember reading in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago that they were getting involved in the industry because there was a lot of money to be made in the soils and amendments involved with marijuana growing because the market was expanding with medical marijuana. So yes, I think more people will grow it. I think prices will drop, and it won't be worth the effort and money to involved in bringing in a crop out in the forest. And unfortunately, I think everybody will not be able to make a good living at it anymore. But I think that what we're paying for it now, being in this sort of quasi-legal realm, is not worth it. I think it's when we look at what it costs our country to enforce this, who's getting arrested is not the growers in Humboldt. Like 88% of people that are arrested is for possession only, not for cultivation. And 3 out of 4 are people of color.
Right.
Even though their use rates are the same, our marijuana laws are applied in really racist ways. And I think that it's for all these, and then also there's the environment. At the moment, it's unregulated agriculture. And I wrote an op-ed about this in the Daily Beast recently that, it's an unregulated crop. So it's being grown with a lot of pesticides that are damaging streams and injuring and killing forest creatures, owls, and this little badger that's bleeding out when it's becoming endangered in Northern California. So there's a lot of side effects. It just affects a lot of areas, more than just a stoner issue. It affects a lot of different parts of our lives.
Well, that was my next question, was on the environmental damage that is being done by the crop. But I wonder, you know, if it then becomes legal and becomes kind of another big agriculture industry, is that going to make the environmental destruction less or even more?
Well, grapes are grown all over California, and there's regulations on how much pesticides you can use and how much water, and there's rules and that people have to abide by. And, you know, I also think Bob in the book, this is sort of getting back to the mom and pops, but you know, he sort of foresees that, of course, big business is going to get involved, of course, because there's a lot of money and this is America, but that there will always be sort of, you know, room for the microbreweries, if you will. So if you can grow a really good artisanal marijuana, there'll be a market for that versus the sort of lesser grade industrial stuff. But I think everybody would have to abide by agricultural laws. And for instance, most of the marijuana, I think, consumed in this country right now is grown indoors. It's gotten very popular. And growing a plant indoors is really impractical and really, really wasteful and uses a lot of electricity. And we don't think about this. We don't talk about it because marijuana has been taboo for so long. And I think legalizing it would no longer be worth the amount of electricity it uses to grow it indoors. So I think it can only be good to legalize it and regulate growing practices.
And we should point out Bob is the sheriff in the book, and he is in favor of legalization, and the child of a stoner family as well. So you're saying is, you know, we're talking here about the carbon emissions of marijuana.
Yeah. There was a scientist out here who did a study that sort of went off online. It just exploded, and then we got tons of coverage. And he was called Up in Smoke, the indoor carbon footprint of indoor cannabis growing, or something like that. It was definitely called Up in Smoke, and he studied this and was the first person to really look at it, because that whole area has been unregulated as well. And there's all these energy. California is a very progressive state when it comes to energy regulation. And the lights used to grow marijuana are the same intensity as in an operating room. It's a couple hundred times more than a reading lamp. I mean, they are bright.
Wow.
And the reason people started growing indoors is because it was illegal.
So maybe yeah. With legalization, we can look forward to free trade, organic marijuana in Whole Foods.
Oh, yeah, definitely. a lot of the people in Humboldt were hoping for that, and Mayor was involved in a collective that was hoping to market to exactly that segment of the population cares about what kind of marijuana, you know, what they put in their body, and just like, you know, people were buying organic heirloom tomatoes and free-range eggs, that they would be interested in that same kind of quality marijuana.
Well, Emily Brady, your book, Humboldt, Life on America's Marijuana Frontier, is just a terrific read, and I've really enjoyed speaking with you here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You can read an excerpt from Humboldt County by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Drew Adamack talks with Susan Stinson about her novel, Spider in a Tree.
Puff the magic dragon lived by the sea, and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Hanalei. Little Jackie Paper loved that rascal Puff, and brought him strings and sealing wax and other fancy stuff. Oh, Puff the Magic Dragon.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Last week, we heard an excerpt from an earlier interview Drew Adamek did with Susan Stinson about Spider in a Tree, her novel about the 18th century firebrand preacher, Jonathan Edwards. That interview was part of our just-concluded special series about the Connecticut River and its communities. The river runs through us. But today's interview is new and in greater depth. Here's Drew.
Susan Stinson is a novelist, historical tour guide, writing coach, speaker, and the writer-in-residence for the Forbes Library in Northampton. She has published three novels and recently completed her fourth, Spider in a Tree. Spider in a Tree is an ambitious historical novel about the life, family, and slaves of influential 18th-century Calvinist theologian and preacher Jonathan Edwards. Drawing on her daily contact with the same landscape and surroundings of the Puritans, Stinson creates a deeply evocative and dramatic journey of spiritual awakening among the townspeople and slaves of 18th century Northampton, Massachusetts. The book follows Edwards and his wife Sarah, their 11 children, their slaves Leah and Saul, and Edwards' nephews Joshua and Elisha Howley, as they struggle to attain spiritual grace, confront human failings, and navigate the strict social conventions of their time. But Spider in a Tree goes beyond just a traditional narrative. Insects preach the gospel back to the main characters. The landscape comes alive with meaning and portent, and historical documents paint a heart-rending portrait of frailty, strength, temptation, redemption, and ultimately tragedy. I talked to Susan about her deep connection to the places that Jonathan Edwards walked, worked, and preached, the spiritual connection between Jonathan Edwards and the present, and how spiritual grace and writerly inspiration are related. Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm so happy to be here.
I always find this to be the hardest question to ask, but what is Spider in a Tree about?
Yeah, well, it's about the Great Awakening. We're calling it a Great Awakening novel. It's about Northampton in the time of Jonathan Edwards, the 18th century preacher, theologian, and slave owner.
And for listeners, who is Jonathan Edwards and why is he important to American history and American culture?
He's best known for his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And he has an image in there of God dangling sinners over the fires of hell, like a person might dangle a spider over the hearth fires. That's where the title of the book comes from. And he helps spark a big series of religious revivals called the Great Awakening that swept through the colonies in the 18th century. It was one of the first times when the separate colonies had people moving in between them and maybe started to form an identity that would be part of what led to the revolution or maybe part of what made it happen, the American Revolution. And also, he's brilliant. He's an amazing writer. He's a really important figure for his eloquence and his rigor of thought. He was on the spot when so much was about American culture that's still active today was just forming. And it's important to me to note, because it's been kind of rarely noted, that he owned slaves. And that was part of that formation of the country as a whole, not just in the South, you know. I think that's important for me that we grapple with that.
And I'm going to come back to that a little later on, but I want to ask, how did it come to be that you've written a book about an 18th century Calvinist preacher?
Yeah, well, I started to write about Jonathan Edwards really because I live in Northampton where the book is set. I should say Northampton, Massachusetts. And I live across the street from the cemetery where many members of Jonathan Edwards' family are buried and many people in the community who turned out to be characters in the book. And I was walking there really regularly. It's a really beautiful place, big old trees and grass. And I was riding there sometimes, and I got really interested in the people who were there. There's headstones. Some of them have poetry. They're very beautiful. And trying to figure out more about who they were.
Jonathan Edwards, particularly in the beginning of the book, is looking for people who are experiencing grace.
Yes.
And yet he almost misses, or does he miss, that Leah, his slave, is probably the person in most direct contact with grace throughout the book. What's that relationship like between Jonathan and Leah and her experiences of religion and grace, and what comes of that?
Yeah, well, I think that he sees it in her. During his time, 6 African-American slaves joined the church, and that's the first time on record that that happened. And I think that he recognized, so then in the fictional version, I think that he recognizes Leah's soul, but he's in such a hierarchical society that he has to treat it as something lesser than his own, you know. And he has left some writing where he's working on that idea. He's thinking about the hierarchy, and he's trying to tell himself to be more respectful of people lesser than him. And he says, just think, you know, an archangel has so much more value as a being than a flea. I'm kind of more like the flea. I'm closer to my slaves than I am to anything else. So he was trying to embrace a little more humility in that way. But of course, he certainly, there was no question in his mind that, you know, the slaves would be lesser beings than he was.
In my mind, in the book, one of the key characters that develop is Leah,
yes,
the slave girl. Will you tell us a little bit about who she is and how she travels through this book?
I love Leah, and she's a lot of people who's read it. They've told me she's their favorite character. She comes into the book when he buys her. And in that transaction, I go back and forth between their points of view. So for a while, you're with Jonathan Edwards, and for a while, you're with Leah, which is important to me in that we're not just seeing the world through his eyes, that there are other eyes to see it the world through, you know. Religion and this kind of religion, Calvinism, becomes very important to her. She joins the church. So that's a way to function. I mean, it's important in terms of her spiritual life, and it's also a way to be part of the society. It's kind of the only avenue that there is for her to be an official member of a public body who is acknowledged not just for their work, but for her value as a human soul. It's access to reading. So there's a lot of things that come to Leah through that, through joining the church, in addition to grace, right? You know, because she's sincere in her beliefs. And then she also, I mean, she's around for the birth of all those children. She develops relationships of her own with the other slaves in the town, with the other slave in the Edwards household. She's a lovely character.
Very early in the book, there's a death in Jonathan Edwards' family.
Yes.
That sets parts of this family on a different course. Will you talk about what that is and how that propels the book forward, that tension based around that death?
That is such an interesting thing, because what happens is that in a very early revival, his uncle Holly, Joseph Holly, was married to his mother's sister, was in distress about his soul, and he killed himself. And, you know, to Jonathan Edwards, that looks like the devil, Satan whispering in his ear. And he wrote a postscript about that death in his fateful narrative, The Account of the Revival. So that was published with all the versions. It was part of the story from the beginning. So that story started traveling throughout the Atlantic world. And when George Whitefield came to New England, he was from England, and he was one of the central preachers of the Great Awakening. They said you would faint just from hearing him saying the word Mesopotamia. He had a booming voice, which was, of course, so important in that time. Part of what brought him was Northampton was correspondence with Edwards, and because he had read The Fateful Narrative. So that death was part of the revivals. And as I read what happened in the relationships between the people involved, including that's Joseph Holly II, his children with Jonathan Edwards, I started to see, oh, well, that death had maybe really, really influenced kind of everything that happened in the course of Jonathan Edwards' relationship to Northampton.
This book is very evocative of these characters and evocative of their spiritual life. But they're dead hundreds of years.
Yeah.
How did being in the very same physical space that these characters inhabited, how did that inform your work and how did that shape your experience of these characters as you were writing them?
Oh, it was huge. I mean, it was, as I said, you know, the cemetery, it was kind of what started it all. And it was, I can't even tell you how much of a pleasure that is for me still to walk through the place that I live, and I've lived here kind of a while now, more than 20 years, yeah, and to have a sense of these other lives and other people who had been here before, and to understand a little more about why the cemetery is in the center of town but not right in the ground of the meeting house, you know, why the town was laid out the way it is, where the rivers used to be, right in the middle of town where they used to have to, they had bridges across where Route 9 is, like right at the entrance of my street, practically, they used to have to cross a little, they call it Freshet, I don't know if I'm saying that word right. So the people and also the landscape, it's just amazing to be knowing a little more and a little more and a little more about what has been where I live before my time.
You are listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Drew Adamek, and I'm talking to Susan Stinson about her book Spider in a Tree. What was Jonathan Edwards' relationship to slavery?
Jonathan Edwards' relationship to slavery was very intimate, you know. I mean, he had people enslaved in his household. He had a wife and he had 11 children, and then living there with them were at least one or two slaves. And it was so intimate that records of the slaves show up in the midst of his work. So there's a receipt from when he went to Newport, Rhode Island, and bought a 14-year-old girl, like on the back side of, it's actually several different pieces of his writing because he cut it up and sewed it into a booklet. So it's there with the records that we have of his brilliant work. And in his will, there is a section called quick stock, like livestock, you know, like for animals. And listed in that section is a boy named Titus.
This book, the language that the characters use feels so authentic. And there are italicized portions that are clearly historical research. But how did the research process inform the words of these characters? And how did you find their words through the research that you were doing?
Well, I read Jonathan Edwards for the first time, and I had to learn how to read him. Because he was an 18th century writer and theologian, he was a preacher too. So he was always talking to just, you know, a cross-section of people in the meeting house. So he wrote to communicate. So that was a gift, you know, and he's good at it. But the language is slower and kind of feels a little more elaborate than what I was used to. And so I had to kind of change the speed with which I read and the speed with which I thought. I really had to slow down and let it enter me. It's not that different from the way I looked at insects while I was writing. I had to slow down and notice, you know, the flies or bugs or beetles or spiders around me if I wanted to accurately describe them. And I also had to slow down to let the 18th century enter my language and become something that was available to me. And I'm hoping that the act of reading the book will kind of offer that to other people if they want it.
I found that in several places. And one of the instances in which the 18th century in this book came alive for me were the descriptions of the food.
Yeah.
Where did you find, I don't want to say the recipes, but the food in the book and the sensual experience of food in this book really brought that to life. Where did that come from?
Well, it came from several different places. I started looking at old cookbooks. Lydia Maria Child, who lived in Northampton for a while, she had a 19th century cookbook that was called the Frugal Housewife, I think is the name of it. And it was full of these wild recipes that you, and frugal, like how you could use earwax to polish things. I mean, we're not wasting anything, you know. So that was one source. There was something called the Dublin Seminars that happens every summer at Deerfield. And if people are interested in the what they call material culture, I didn't have that phrase when I started. And it was so useful because that's the things that last, you know, furniture, food is part of it. It's the physical world as opposed to the world of books, the intellectual world, which often is what we receive as history. This is the material world. And so things like food, and it's also where you find often the culture as it related to women, you know, which I'm always interested in and finding ways into that. So they published books from their seminars and they focused on food. They focused on clothing. They focused on journals. And so I had through that lists of like advertisements for things that were available in local stores, you know? I mean, so then you really got, it's so powerful in conveying the sense of daily life. If you know, oh, if they got a shipment of rock salt into Hadley, boy, people got in the wagon and went and got it because you wanted salt. That was really important.
One of the surprises throughout this book, for me, one of the stereotypes that I had sort of abolished by this book was the Calvinist as very staid, very unemotional. And in the scenes of the Great Awakening in church in particular, it's physical, it's compassionate. I mean, these people were really on fire for religion, weren't they?
Well, they were. I'm so glad you asked me about that because Jonathan Edwards was that was one of his big fights within the church, is that he was advocating for emotion in religion. And that was part of the spark of the Great Awakening. And so, yes, in these otherwise, actually, it's true, pretty rigid societies, at the moment of awakening or revival, people fell on the floor. They'd be crying. They'd be singing. They'd be expressing themselves. And it went on for hours. He has one sentence from, I think, the 1730s. It might be even the early 1740s. If you walk through town, you would hear outcries and calls from just a bunch of different houses. And people would be so overcome that they would stay there all night. They wouldn't be able to get home. Now, though, when he talked about emotions, what he called religious affections or affections, he didn't just mean happiness, though. He also meant anger and fear and hatred, because he felt that those were all useful. You know, if you were frightened in your short mortal life, and your fear was what got you to turn to God, that would be worth it, because that would keep you out of suffering for all eternity. That's how he saw that.
You are listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Drew Adamek, and I'm talking to Susan Stinson about her book, Spider in a Tree. So much of this book centers around the experience and the observation of nature, which is evocative of Edward's own philosophy. What was his relationship to nature, and how did you try to capture that in this book?
Well, his relationship to nature was one of my big ways in, because we were living in the same landscape. And his relationship to nature was just very active. He regularly went on horseback rides, maybe through the meadows and up into the hills. And he, while he was out in the woods, he's left accounts of important spiritual moments that happened in the woods under a particular tree. One of the things that I had access to, I think it was a note in one of his account books, was a description of how to find a cranberry bog. And it was, you know, okay, you go by this one split tree. I used it for something that some of these other characters, when you couldn't go to Google Earth, right? You know, I mean, so you had to really write down what you saw if you wanted to find your way back there again and get the cranberries. But while he was riding, he also, horseback riding, like through the woods, he would pin notes, pieces of paper, to his coat if he had ideas while he was riding, that's one of the reasons he went out. He had them a lot. And that would be a record for him of what he wanted to write as soon as he got back. So that was all true. And also, he looked at everything around him as if, according to his belief, that God created the world and that everything in it communicated itself towards the redemption of human souls and for the greater glory of God. And so if he saw hillside, he would always be thinking about what that meant in relationship to God.
Will you talk a little bit about why you included insects in this book and what their role is?
I think the insects are on their own agenda. One thing I think of them as is emissaries from that time. They were there then, and they're there now, and they may have changed a little, you know, as the climate changes or whatever, but they haven't changed a lot. And when I realized that, you know, Jonathan Edwards would be feeling a spider on his skin just like I did, that was a really good way into their sensual lives, you know, that we were having those same experience. That's one thing. And also, it's because the power and persuasiveness of the Calvinist story about what the world is and what our role in the world is and how we perceive relationships between beings and human beings, animals, insects, everything, you know, it's very clear, and it's kind of gorgeous, and it's compelling enough that it's really hung around, kind of not always explicitly, in a lot of our institutions and the way we understand and speak about culture. And those insects, they don't know that story, says me. You know, so they're kind of doing other insect business. That's why I looked at them. I really tried to see what they were actually doing. And that alone makes them very compelling. But sometimes, I mean, they were with him too. Sometimes some of Jonathan Edwards' language starts showing up in some of their reflections. So it's not a clear image. It's a messy one. And I think so for me, it also kind of points to things that you really can't quite articulate, but are important and always kind of buzzing around.
One of the beauties of this book for me is its obvious joy in language, but the relationship that the characters have with God and the way that they try to approach God and the way that they try to experience God through open attention, through divine inspiration. So much of that seemed like exactly the experience that a writer would have, to pay attention, to bring shadows into language.
That's Jonathan Edward. Yeah, I think he did that himself through his writing. I feel that, you know. And you're absolutely right. I mean, that's certainly one of the ways that I get to grace, you know, is through attentive language, through really paying attention to what's happening at any given moment, including what I'm feeling, what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing, what I understand, what other people would be expressing, and then trying to describe it with as much elegant accuracy. And really, the accuracy is more important than the elegance, to try to be as true as I can to any given moment. If I can do that, then I can translate it, you know, to many different times and places. And that, to me, that's the grace, that the essence of that moment can travel through time in an amazing way.
How do you feel about the relationship that Jonathan Edwards ultimately ends up having with Northampton at the end of this story?
When I first heard the story, it really reminded me of classical Shakespearean tragedy. I mean, it's Jonathan Edwards as King Lear, because the thing that he most loved and that he poured his whole spirit and self into building this church, you know, they turn against him and reject him. And one of the things that is the hope for me, or the one of the things that I find kind of beautiful about Jonathan Edwards in that moment, is that as far as I can see, he didn't have a moment of shakiness. I mean, he was writing letters to ministers in Scotland. They were saying, come to Scotland, you know, all over the place. And he, well, you know, it's a mixed thing. It's his pride. He was so proud. He was so confident of his own reading of Scripture and his own, the proper way to conduct yourself as a church member, that he didn't, if he doubted, it never showed. So that pride is both what kept him going and led him to move on to other amazing things. I mean, he wrote his strongest work later, after he went to Stockbridge. And also, why he couldn't bend, he couldn't understand the point of view of the townspeople. I mean, it was both things. And that's tragedy.
One of the most beautiful things about this book, because I have lived in Northampton, one of the most beautiful things about this book to me is the connection that it draws to the place that I live now. You know, I cross Bridge Street every day, but you offer, outside of the book, even closer contact with that. Will you talk a little bit about your cemetery tours?
Oh, the cemetery tour. Yeah. Well, I love to hear you say that, because, I mean, that's kind of my dream, is everyone read the book. And if you come through Northampton, or if you live there, it will transform for you. But yes, I give cemetery tours. So there's one coming up. There's the book launch. And then the cemetery tour is going to be in October 5th at 1 p.m. at the Bridge Street Cemetery. It costs $5, and the tickets are available now at Broadside Books. And you can get them at the book launch too, which is on the 2nd, at the First Churches, which is where Jonathan Edwards preached, which makes me so happy that I get to read there. So yeah, we walk through the cemetery, which was so important to me in writing the book, and it's important to me in my daily life now, and was so important to the Edwards family because of what it represented in terms of bringing the awareness to people as they pass through that cemetery, that we are all going to die. And so you should really be thinking, you know, get right with God. That was their idea about it. And also because of the people who were buried there, and the amazing way that their individual stones contain so much story about where we are. And the stones, many of them are very beautiful too. They've got great carvings. So, and you know, a beautiful, sunny, like autumn afternoon, it's a great thing to do.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure.
Great to talk to you, Drew.
Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Spider in a Tree. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.